OPG Management Editorial Board Member Dr. Cheryl Iglesias attended the July 10th and 11th FDA hearing on laparoscopic power morcellation as a member of the Obstetrics and Gynecology Devices Panel Advisory Committee. In this audio cast, she describes the hearing and the panel's recommendations, as well as many of the fine points considered in weighing the risks and benefits of power morcellation. Dr. Iglesias is director of the Section of Female Pelvic Medicine and Reconstructive Surgery at MedStar Washington Hospital Center, an associate professor in the departments of OBGYN and Urology at Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. Dr. Iglesias, could you describe your role on the FDA's Obstetrics and Gynecology Devices Panel Advisory Committee?
So I am considered a special government employee, and I have a 5-year term on the OBGYN Devices Panel. I was a member of the panel that reviewed vaginal mesh, and this is my second OBGYN Devices Panel as a consultant on paramorcellation for laparoscopy. After the hearing, which was July 10th and 11th, we make recommendations as a panel, but no final decisions are made until everything has been reviewed by officials at the FDA, and the FDA will come up with final decisions based in part on some of the recommendations that the panel has made. Therefore, I can't give you an official view, and what I'll be talking about right now mostly represents my own opinion.
Just to review, what was the goal of the 2-day hearing and whose points of view were represented to the panel?
The goal was to discuss the risk of disseminating unsuspected uterine malignancy with paramorcellation. And, you know, we talked on the panel about what the risk is of occult leiomyosarcoma in women with uterine fibroids. We talked about the preoperative screening evaluation process, talked about options for intraoperative strategies and to minimize or mitigate intraperitoneal fragmentation or dissemination of the tissue. And, you know, they talked about various types of morcellators and moving forward if leiomyosarcoma was diagnosed, whether or not paramorcellation upgraded an occult malignancy, and what the benchmark should be for future devices, and whether or not future devices, not just with the paramorcellate, but with containment, like containment bags, how they should be evaluated and tested moving forward. And there was also some discussion about the role of registries.
What final recommendations did the panel make to the FDA?
Overall, there was a very long discussion about what the risk of having an unsuspected sarcoma, and, you know, the rates ranged from 1 in 350 to 1 in 7,450. And what we as a panel realized is that while there are some indicators that could be suspicious for leiomyosarcoma, particularly on an MRI, that one cannot be 100% certain, particularly when you have a fibroid that's degenerating, and that, you know, it's not just leiomyosarcoma, but other occult malignancies. And the bottom line is the patients must be adequately worked up, particularly if there is abnormal bleeding. And an evaluation would include normal cervical cytology, normal endometrial sampling, either sonograms and MRIs if indicated. And, you know, we talked about patient selection, in particular being very worried about using morcellation in the postmenopausal woman who's bleeding. We talked a lot about other options for morcellation, and in general, you know, if you can remove a uterus through the vagina or intact, that's ideal because, you know, there's a lot of data about the pros and cons from the vaginal approach for hysterectomy, but that we're not 100% certain that containment bags are going to be the be-all and end-all, in that particularly if you're doing subtotal hysterectomies, you still might be cutting through cancers or cold malignancies, and that the containment bags are very thin, that there's a possibility that there could be leakage and or breakage or unintended injury to other intraperitoneal organs like bowel and vessels, et cetera. So we can't be complacent about just being 100% certain that things don't go awry even with the use of a bag.
Was there any final recommendations about informed consent?
A lot of discussion, particularly on the second day, was in the area of labeling special controls, and it would be labeling for patients and practitioners or physicians, surgeons who are using the morcellator. To the extent that, and there have been some precedents, I think, in silicone breast and other devices where both the patient and the physician have to sign off that they are aware that morcellators may be used, that, you know, there's a potential for a dissemination of an occult malignancy or even, you know, dissemination of benign disease like leiomyomatosis and incomplete removal. There are risks of using the morcellator in terms of injury. Just a whole kind of like a checklist, but it's interesting for the labeling, both the patient and the physician in this, one of the recommendations for special controls would be included.
And would that involve a black box warning?
You know, I think there was several discussion about the black box warning. I'm not sure what the final discussion is. Some people believe that with the black box on an administrative level, it sends a signal and as a reminder to everyone about the labeling. Labeling can be done without a black box. It can be done with a black box. And I'm not 100% certain how that will ultimately be decided upon by the FDA.
What were your reactions to the hearing, apart from your role on the panel? Did you feel that adequate testimony was heard from all the parties that have a stake in the immediate and long-term fate of laparoscopic power morcellation?
You know, I think that the FDA did an excellent job in convening all the players. Anybody who had interest in this field, I feel, was represented from industry and companies that make morcellators, companies that make containment bags. I felt that medical societies, ACOG and Hal Lawrence gave testimony. AAGL's testimony was very powerful, particularly by Dr. Jubilee Brown in mentioning that without the morcellator, more women may be subjected to an abdominal procedure, which in and of itself has some morbidity and mortality associated with that type of operation. And that was a nice study analysis. They're about, in terms of a decision tree, you know, what the potential harms would be without available morcellators to use. And I thought the MRI imaging that was done by the radiologist was also very interesting and discussed, you know, the limits of our ability to detect. I also found some of the testimony to be extremely powerful from the patients, including that of Dr. Amy Reed and her family and the other women who presented. In some of the cases, we and several people on the panel, including myself, did wonder about the selection or the choice to use the morcellator in the first place in some cases, particularly in women who had growing fibroids and they were postmenopausal. I think that would be a particular case where, you know, go ahead and make an incision because there's a potential higher index of suspicion for cancer in those kinds of cases.
Do you care to predict whether gynecologic surgeons will continue to use power morcellators after this controversy?
You know, and this was also discussed by Dr. Fisher, Dr. Gustine, and some of the officials from the FDA that, you know, if anything, this would be, you know, a call for innovation, improving products that can morcellate and contain at the same time. And I know that we have some hysteroscopic morcellators that, you know, you can insert and there's a vacuum, and so things get kind of vacuumed up. And whether or not we can develop something that has very little spill, obviously none at all, would be key. And, you know, I do believe that at some point there will be some ingenuity and some improvements made to the current devices that will allow us to continue this in our armamentarium. What was interesting was that one of the questions that was addressed to the panel was, well, when do you see that the benefits may outweigh the risks in what population? And leiomyosarcoma, and which is just, you know, one of the occult malignancies, and there were other, there's different types of sarcomas, including MMTs, mixed mesodermal tumors, and endometrial stromal sarcomas, and other, you know, endometrial cancer and malignancies. And what's interesting is that when you look at fibroids, and even when you do a myomectomy, it's not necessarily just the power of morcellation. It's just cutting through cancer or morcellating either vaginally or open. You're doing an open myomectomy, just removal of the fibroid, and it turns out that that's cancer. You know, that is not a good prognosis to start with, but to spread it, you know, clearly is not good for the patient as well and makes a bad condition even worse. But it really means that we need to do a better job in, you know, preoperatively identifying patients. And while we're there, you know, mention we did mention on the panel that, you know, maybe we can develop risk calculators or ways to stratify based on, you know, the MRI imaging, patient age, patient race, you know, whether or not something has a higher index of suspicion for being cancerous. What I meant to say is the two benefits were outweighed the risk. One other case was, you know, the young 20-something-year-old fertility patient with the fibroids that clearly have an impact. I mean, you don't want to do a hysterectomy, and you still want to do a remove the fibroid in as minimally invasive way as possible, and morcellation may be the best in terms of, you know, creating less adhesions. The other case was something that I had mentioned in patients who have prolapse who you're thinking about placing mesh. Some people do subtotal hysterectomies and then attach the mesh to the cervix as opposed to the vaginal cuff to decrease the risk of cuff erosion. And that's another technique where benefits might lead to the risk, particularly in, you know, older postmenopausal women with not particularly enlarged uteri. So more to come.